Bangly Bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, we make loud noises with Adam McKay as he tells us how Feist almost killed him. Feist, the movie, not Feist as in being addicted to heroin. That didn't almost kill him. I have to make that absolutely clear for legal reasons.
I think it was either Christian Bale or Dick Cheney just saved my life.
Plus the usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is being recorded back to back and being released over two consecutive weeks. It's all the rage these days. You guys will not believe the cliffhanger that ends this episode. It is going to be huge. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by the full set, the full complement, three colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, we have our glorious leader, Empire's editor-in-chief, Terry White.
Hi, Chris.
What have you been up to? What have you been doing?
What have I been doing? Making a magazine? Empire magazine? Have you heard of it?
Yeah. No, is it any good?
You know.
Okay.
Three stars.
I'll check it out. Three stars, as we always say in this podcast, is of course a recommendation. Next up we have our geek queen, just back from exotic climes, but probably can't say where or why or when or how.
No.
Or why? Did I say why already?
No, I can't say any of those things.
Helen
O'Hara. I can say that live gunfire was involved, probably. Doesn't narrow it down.
Northern Ireland.
Much.
You went back home.
That's right. Hey.
Well done. How
exotic
were they?
Exotic climbs of Northern Ireland. God
it's
bless.
It's got a coast.
It does have a coast.
It's got a giant's causeway. That's exotic.
It does have a giant's causeway.
How many places have something that was built by a giant?
There is the other end of it in Scotland, in that cave.
Shut up, Helen. Shut up. And James Dyer is also here, which is nice, I guess.
Hi, Chris.
You all right, Jimbo?
Yes. I feel like with Terry here, we just need to get Boyd in and then we can just take over and make it a pilot TV spin-off.
Oh, good Lord.
Co-pro.
But you're the spin-off.
I like to think that in many ways, like CSI Miami before it, we have surpassed the original many ways.
A better example would be Law and Order Special Victims
Unit. Oh, here we go.
Versus
here we go.
The original Law
No,
and Order.
The better example would be NCIS because nobody even remembers
who watched
what it was.
NCIS LA?
No. NCIS itself is a spin-off.
Is it?
TV man. Well done.
I'm James.
Oh, hang on. Was it Jag?
Hey, you got there in the air.
Yes. I host a pilot
oh my
TV.
God.
I know everything.
I used to watch Jag. I've never watched NCIS, but I watched Jag religiously when it was on.
Well, NCIS is better than Jag.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
No, it's not.
I think Terry does make a good point, though, about how SVU has in many ways eclipsed Law & Order. But did you know, Terry, that
not
season
in many ways.
20... No. I'm not even going to get it. That's a discussion for pilot TV. Cutting that bit out. Because SVU, as of this season, season 20, has equaled Law & Order's record. And Law & Order itself had equaled the record of Gunsmoke for longest-running live-action US TV series.
This is not the TV anniversary we want to talk about, though. It's coming up on 300 episodes of Supernatural, so let's keep our focus where it should be. Thank you very much.
Helen, what do you say to a pilot TV Supernatural special that you could come on?
That would be great. Yes, please.
Categorically not. Not to Helen. Categorically not to Supernatural.
It's going to be an all topless podcast in honour of Sam and Dean.
Literally 10
Josh,
years.
You and Boyd. Josh, you and Boyd.
Moobs out for the ladies.
That's it.
Whoa. Come on. There are no moobs on that show.
She's not.
Not in Supernatural, but in the spin-off podcast.
Sure, gotcha.
Me and Boyd are no Sam and Dean.
I'm sorry, you've broken me. Nothing more to add.
Excellent. So Supernatural's now 300 episodes in. I was very sad this week to hear that Criminal Minds is going to be finishing after 15 seasons and over 300 episodes. They've been commissioned for their 15th and final season of just 10 episodes to wrap it up.
It's time.
Who's left?
It is time.
It
who's
is
left?
Time.
Like, Hotch has gone. You know, Mandy Patinkin went a long time ago.
Well, Mandy Patinkin went after season two.
Yeah.
Hotch, Thomas Gibson, went after, how should we say, an onset contretemps.
And Shamar Moore's now in that SWAT show, isn't he? So he's not in anymore.
De la vu?
Yes. Shamar Moore's there. There's still loads left.
Derek's left.
Yeah, he's there. Yeah.
He's still in it.
What about Matthew Gray Gubbler? Is he still in it?
Yeah, he's still in it as Dr. Dr. Spence Reed. It's probably Kermit the Frog.
Yeah.
I actually can't do a Spence Reed impression, but for some reason now it's coming out like Kermit the Frog. I'm Spencer Reed.
I mean, that's
I
not
solve
that
crimes.
Dissimilar.
Yeah, that's true.
Has he cut his hair yet?
He cuts his hair quite a lot, and then it grows long again, and it gets unkempt and disheveled. Joe Mantegna is still in it. Paget Brewster's like a yo-yo. She leaves the show. She comes back to the show. She leaves the show. She comes back to the show. Paget Brewster, you know her from...
I do, from the Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Yeah, and Friends, where she played...
I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
Kathy.
Kathy.
Oh, oh cheat
yeah,
on Chandler.
She did pay Kathy. The Velveteen Rabbit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's all coming back to me now.
Yeah. She came between Chandler and Joey.
That's it.
But not in a sex way.
I mean, literally in a sex way, but, you know.
Tide 45 this week, everybody. Tide 45. Anyway, shall we have a question?
Sure.
Here we go. The question is from Twitter. It is from @Liono32. As we enter 2019, what's the ultimate movie news you'd like to hear in the coming year, says Liono32, who then goes on to say, for example, the announcement of new adaptations, sequels. What's on your wish list? Gene Hackman to come out of retirement? Pixels 2?
Well, I know that's your wish list, Chris, right?
Yeah, both he somehow those. Incepted me.
Yeah, I think he has. I'm hoping that somebody will be sorting through the late William Goldman's papers and find a completed script for Buttercup's Baby, which will then be made as some kind of animation with most of the original cast returning to voice it. I know I've said this before over the years, but I live in hope. That would be the sequel, of course, to The Princess Bride, for those not keeping up at the back. Also, you know, I'd like the surprise news that Captain America is staying on for 9 more movies, all of them with the beard. And I don't mean Sharon Carter. Thank you.
There you go.
Okay.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? What sort of utopia would we live in then? This is movie news. We can't do any political stuff. Let's stay away from that. Terry, what would you like?
2 things.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm kind of desperate for somebody to make The Power, you know, Naomi Oldman's book. I know there's talk of it being a TV series. I actually think it should be a film. I think if it becomes a TV series, it's going to be very kind of Handmaid's Tale, episodic grimness that kind of essentially whittles down into being something that feels like you're ripping your own skin off every week. I think a fantastically constructed 90-minute film is what I'm after. Mm. And I also want Kes 2.
I feel like we're both quite on brand.
I mean, yeah. Could it be more?
How would that work?
Well, I was thinking, because obviously it's been dead years and I realise that it's a long time between films. Mm-hmm. But then what if there was a way to resurrect the original Kes due to science? Science means that Kes comes back to life and Billy Casper must now be what, like 60 or whatever, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Billy Casper, in the final chapter of his own life, brings back to life Kes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Last of the Summer Wine, but with more birds.
that's a log line I can get on board with.
All right, okay. So it's not the original Kes, which is obviously, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers away for Kes, but...
Because ultimately...
But the bird dies.
The bird dies, but it's a film of hope and optimism, because actually a boy who was looking at nothing apart from a life down the pit and turning into his older brother and drinking too much and, you know, actually found hope and optimism and beauty in the world via his relationship with Kes. It's an optimistic film until the bird dies. But actually, all it shows is that he has that capacity to love and to be loved inside him.
How about you, James? What would you like to see, positively thinking?
What would I like to see? I would like to see, in the wake of the Fox-Disney merger, for them to finally announce that the original Star Wars trilogy will be released in high def, properly remastered, unaltered by Lucas in their theatrical format. That would be very nice.
With the Fox fanfare.
With the Fox fanfare. Oh, yeah. If it has Wish Upon a Star at the beginning, and we burn the house down. I'd also like to see Aliens released in 4K and cleaned up, because that is a film that has an awful lot of film grain on it. If you watch it now, even in HD, it does not look good. So it would cost a lot of money, I think, to properly remaster that for 4K. And I would like James Cameron to do that. What's hilarious, though, is that Cameron has a backlog of stuff, so there's no Blu-ray release of The Abyss or... I think True Lies at the moment, mm-hmm. but apparently he has versions of that waiting for his approval. Like, they've done passes on it and he needs to sign off on it, but he's so busy with Avatar he just can't spare the time to look at them. So it's in limbo because his schedule doesn't allow
it. True?
That's what he says.
James Cameron's schedule, I believe, contracts and moves depending on what he chooses to spend his time on.
I mean, Avatar is the answer, and like mung bean salads.
And massively producing Alita, which he was very hands-on on a daily basis.
Yeah, that too. And occasionally sending notes to the set of the new Terminator film. But, you know, so he's got other things on his plate. But, you know, get off your arse, Jim. You know.
I don't think that man sat in his arse in years.
Yeah. Start working on Aliens, please.
He pays other people to sit in his arse for him. That sounded weirder than I intended. To,
no.
What I mean is...
As your lawyer...
Yes. No,
he has other people to sit down for him.
Right.
That's what I meant, where he does all the running around. I didn't mean a weird sex thing, if that's what you thought I was...
No. I'd also like to see Eric Idle and Robbie Coltrane reunite for Nuns on the Run 2.
Oh, Christ.
Back in the Habit.
That was already used for a Nun sequel, and you know it.
I know. I want to use it again.
Everything's coming up rosaries.
Hey! Hey!
Wow. I didn't deserve that, but okay. If I had one wish, 10-hour Avengers Endgame spoiler special with Russo. So that's what I would want. But that's not really what the question was. The question was, what news would I like to see? I don't know. I'm a pretty simple guy. I've got pretty simple tastes. I want every movie to be an MCU movie. I want a 10-hour Avengers Endgame spoiler special. Those are just crazy. That's never going to happen. And even crazier stuff, I'd like to... two more Mission Impossible movies shot back to back, at least one after the other, and maybe a new Ghostbusters movie directed by the son of the director of the original films.
Chris!
What?
Maybe some of that isn't impossible after all. Maybe it's a Mission Possible.
Holy shit.
That's right.
But Helen, if I could be serious for a second,
sure.
HMVs are firing. I'd like to see that happening, to be honest, because I feel that physical media is important, whether it's DVDs and Blu-rays or just vinyl records. And I think that it's a chain that probably was very instrumental in getting a lot of us into film and music over the years. And I don't like to see people losing their jobs as well. So don't call me Mr. Weird, but that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see HMV surviving. And while you're at it, bring back Blockbuster. All right, if you want to have your question read out in the Opera Podcast, as Lion032 did, much to their dismay, or satisfaction, I'm guessing. You can get in touch via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag EmpirePodcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Before we move on, I do have some sad news I want to share. And it's also, if I'm completely honest, it is a request for you guys as well. Ian Stevens was the former art editor of Empire magazine. He worked at Empire for a number of years. Really, really great guy. Fantastic art editor as well. And it was a valuable part of Empire for many, many years. He now lives in LA with his wife, Nina. And recently he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, which has spread to his brain. He is undergoing treatment for this terrible illness, and it is experimental treatment, and there is a cost involved with that as well, as you might imagine, given the healthcare system in America. So he has a GoFundMe, and it is www.gofundme.com/Ian, I-A-N, dash Stevens, S-T-E-V-E-N-S. He's a great guy, and we would like to keep him alive, please. So if you can donate anything at all to that, then that would be much appreciated. Not just by Empire, of course, but by Ian and his wife, Nina. Get well soon to Steve's. Get well soon. Okay, should we have some movie news now?
Well, there's hardly any this week, is there? I didn't really notice anything.
No?
Oh, wait, you mentioned should those two wish list items you had.
Ah, but that's just crazy, Helen.
Well, is it, though? Let's have a... Oh, my God!
What's happened?
I just looked!
Are you all right?
Christopher McQuarrie, Chris!
Where?
He's
What's
signed
happening?
On for two more Mission Impossible movies to be shot back-to-back.
This is amazing.
This is your dream.
That's what I asked for.
Oh.
I had no prior knowledge of this whatsoever when I said that previous bit.
Oh,
this is incredible. Yes, indeed. So it was announced this week, to much excitement and much rejoicing, that Chris McQuarrie is indeed going to write and direct the next two Mission Impossible movies to be shot back to back, but to be released in summer 2021 and summer 2022. Now, this is exciting. I think it's exciting. I think it's great. The two Mission movies that McQuarrie has directed, Rogue Nation and Fallout, are widely held by many people as the best or amongst the best in the Mission Impossible series, and Fallout in particular was the critical and commercial darling. Biggest film of Tom Cruise's career.
Hey.
Would you believe? At the ripe old age of 56. Now, what do we think about this news? Are we excited about it? What do we think this means for the franchise? There is a prevailing theory that this might be it for Cruise, that he'll be 60 by the time the eighth Mission Impossible movie is released in 2022.
Yes, but 60 in Tom Cruise years is about 35 in normal person years, so you have to kind of bear that in mind.
This is true. This is very true.
Yeah, I categorically do not believe that that will be the end of Tom Cruise. I think what's really exciting is exactly what lengths they're going to go to cinematically from a stunt perspective. You know, he's doing Top Gun at the moment, which has been put back to 2020, primarily because... of I've heard from the ambition of what they're trying to achieve means they needed more time in production at Tom's request. Obviously, we're all very aware, no more so than you, Chris, in your 734 hours of Chris McQuarrie. I think roughly speaking, 734 hours.
That's a conservative estimate, but
yeah, conservative. I don't want to underplay it. You know, the great lengths in terms of the stunts and the practical work, and you just kind of, the mind boggles in terms of.
And that was just one podcast.
Yeah.
There was stunt work in our podcast. Wow. It was amazing.
That's incredible.
Where they're going to go to and what they can possibly try and achieve with this when you've got a filmmaker and, you know, Cruise, who is an actor but also now a filmmaker, their combined talents and ambition. If anyone is going to move the action genre on even further, it has to be them two, right? Mm.
I'm going to steal my own joke from Twitter and say that mankind is going back to the moon. There's no other explanation. I mean, how else does he top what he's done already? Go down to the base of the Marianas Trench, literally climb Everest. I'm not sure what else.
I think we go back to the rattlesnake down the pants scenario that we.
I mean, also that. I mean, maybe all three. He's got two more films to fill, you know. So all of those. But I also do think, you know, we talk about the stunts and the action in Mission Impossible, rightly, because that's such a huge part of it. But also, I think McQuarrie and Cruise work brilliantly together on story and character and weaving those things together and giving the action a purpose and not just doing dazzling things for the sake of being dazzling. It's good storytelling as well as just great, great, incredible stunts. So I'm excited.
Yes, I'm on board too. What more is there to say? The Mission Impossible films are absolutely firing on all cylinders and have been for a while. And the thought of having more of them, absolutely. Give me more. Give me all the missions. Make them impossible.
Fight scene on the Titanic.
Yes.
Well, time travel.
No, literally on the Titanic, on the seabed.
Yeah.
Okay.
In submersibles. Oh. A bit like inner space, but under the sea and not inside Martin Short.
Yeah.
I'm excited about this because if anyone has listened to the 6 hours of Macquarie podcast that we recorded for Mission Impossible Fallout, we'll have probably heard him say multiple times that he's done with it, that he's not going to, he might stick around in a sort of producing capacity on the next one, but pity the poor soul who does the next movie. It's crazy. These things, you know, they kill you. It's exactly what he said on the Rogue Nation spoiler special. So I'm excited because something has happened in the interim. And I don't think it's just that someone drove a huge truck filled with gold bullion up to his house. I think he's had an idea. Mm-hmm. And it's an idea that is big enough for two movies. And that excites me.
It might be a bit like childbirth, though, where it's a horrendous experience. You say you'll never do it again, and then nature makes you forget.
Or maybe he just really likes doing spoiler specials.
It is. It's to get close to you, really. Yeah, that's what it is, isn't it?
All right, so that was the Mission Impossible news. I don't think there's anything else to talk about. I think that's it. Should we just move straight on to the guest?
There might be something else, Chris.
There's something else.
Yeah, what was the other thing on your wish list?
This is crazy. Okay. I wanted a Ghostbusters movie set in the same universe as Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2, but directed by the son of the director of the original movies.
Well, you won't believe it.
What?
But that's actually happening.
And I would like $1 million. Yes. Please, Helen, tell me more about this.
Jason Reitman will be making a new Ghostbusters movie in exactly those circumstances.
There's even a trailer.
There is even a trailer. I mean, it doesn't give a lot away.
No.
But it's happening. It's a thing that is underway.
I have to say, I'm genuinely gobsmacked because I interviewed him a few months ago for The Front Runner, and I have to say, I think he, as a filmmaker, is back on form. You had that Front Runner and Tully last year, both of which I think were fantastic. I think after Up in the Air, he had kind of a difficult couple of years. And when I spoke to him, he was talking about The Front Runner and he was talking about Gary Hart, who's the politician in The Front Runner. And I really loved the character of the daughter in that. And he said, well, it's funny because one of the things we connected over is being the child of somebody famous.
Yeah.
And more to the point, being the child of somebody who, when everybody talks to you, all they want to do is know about your dad. All they want to do is talk about your dad. Not in a kind of that there was a real issue there, but he still clearly felt that to some extent, as much as he's now a respected and recognised director, is that people still go, oh my God, you're the son of Ivan Reitman. So I have to say I was gobsmacked, and I know he's pretty much said for a decade I would be the last person who could or should do a Ghostbusters film. And actually, when he's been quoted around this story, he said, you know, he went to his dad and said, I've got an idea. And his dad was as surprised as anyone else because they'd clearly talked about it. Mm. But he said he had an idea that was so emotional and so great. And he's on board as a producer as well, that he thinks it's amazing and he's really excited by it. So I'm just, you know, you wonder what happened where he felt confident enough in himself as a filmmaker and thought, you know what, fuck it if people come to me and say, oh, it's your dad's film, what you think, that he feels able to put it out there as a filmmaker himself. I don't know if it's because he's just had two really quite successful films that have made him feel like it's the time to take this on. Mm-hmm. But I think it takes proper balls to do that.
I think it does. Because people will look at Jason Reitman's filmography and go, there's nothing like Ghostbusters in his filmography. But he has directed comedy before on the big screen, but also on the small screen as well. He directed a number of episodes of The Office. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lovely story that, you know, he feels so connected to this movie. He said in his statement that Ghostbusters is his favorite film. He's in Ghostbusters 2. He has a single line. There was a shot going around this week of him on the set of Ghostbusters when he was just 6 years old. And if he can bring some of that heart and emotion to the story as well. We know nothing about what it's going to be, but also the funny. He has to bring the funny to it as well. And that little, I don't even know what it is that he circulated today. Is it a teaser? Is it just a test shot that they were shooting? Because this thing has been developed for a while, it seems, in secret under the title Rust City over there at Sony. And it's going to start shooting in a few weeks' time as well, in order for release next year. So that reveal of Ecto-1 under a tarpaulin with special effects already present and looking complete, that fascinated me. I don't know exactly what that is, but that felt interesting. It didn't really feel stylistically like anything in the first two Ghostbusters, but it also felt weirdly of a piece. I guess it was because they used the music.
I think it's also, I'm relieved that they haven't kind of turned their back on the Ghostbusters universe, you know, after the all-female reboot, which we've talked about on the podcast before, the kind of all the issues around that and the horror around that. But it was, you know, what did it take, $229 million? It was a...
It did okay.
But it wasn't kind of either critically or commercially kind of a huge hit. But, you know, Reitman was very kind of keen to point out, I think, that this is part of the same universe, as you say, present day, just as that was present day in the 80s, and kind of distancing... this film away from the last film in terms of, obviously, that was a reboot that existed entirely in silo. And I think that's deliberately to kind of re-engage that spirit we saw with the first two, as you say.
I agree. Jimbo, any thoughts on this?
I'm cautiously optimistic. Like, I'm not like Nick DeSemlin, who insists that Ghostbusters 2 is the superior Ghostbusters film, which is mad. But yeah, I'm on board. I'm happy, but not taking for granted that it will be great.
But did you also see that Dan Aykroyd tweeted, shared the teaser, which got me really excited? Because obviously he's been working on Ghostbusters 3 for the longest time.
Yes, forever.
And I think for this to kind of have his buy-in, we know nothing about who might be back or who might be in it, but I think already it's like, okay, we're a go. This is going to be good.
So what do we think this is going to be? Speculation on the story. There's rumors that he's looking for four teenagers to star in this movie. But do we think that's going to be the focus? Do we think that any of the surviving cast are going to come back? You'd imagine so, right? Mm-hmm. They showed up in the Paul Feig movie.
Nuts.
You'd think they'd show up in this one.
My only trepidation here is there is a part of me that likes the thing that when there is a thing you love, a classic thing, it is on an island of its own. It is a standalone thing and you love it. That it is possible to retroactively diminish something by adding to it.
So what you're saying is we should stop feeding off the 80s nostalgia.
I mean, yes.
A little bit.
A little bit like that. But it's just like, and we'll get into this later on in this podcast, but obviously there's a film out this week which picks up a film that I absolutely love and continues that story. And to my mind has then lessened that original a little bit for me because I will never be able to now watch it again without having this in the back of my head. So sometimes it's not a good thing. Just to end on a really bum note.
Oh, no, because it doesn't diminish the original movie. The original movie remains the same.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no.
No, yes.
I can't explain why you're wrong without giving away the key plot points in Glass. But there are certainly sections of that where, like when I next watch Unbreakable, I will have scenes from Glass in my head and I will be irritated.
But can I just say, on the 80s nostalgia point, Helen is absolutely right. And if you want to hear more from Helen on the 80s, you can pick up the book that she wrote. What's it called? Helen O'Hara's Brilliant 80s Films.
The best 80s movies?
Yes.
Which is not quite true,
It's a subversive text, which is in many ways casting a side eye at the exploitation of 80s nostalgia, but by taking it down from the inside.
No, it's something that I was asked to write and wrote, and in doing so, went back and watched all the 80s films, so I know how exploited they are, because I had to consider how many of them
dangerous.
Have been sequelized and TVI's and everything.
Oh my God, so many.
Rebooted.
You know what hasn't been rebooted?
Uh-huh.
I mean, loads of things. Mm-hmm. Should we start a list? From the 80s, War Games.
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, yeah. You know, by now he should be taking it.
Although there wasn't there a TV show at the time?
There has been a TV show of that. Yeah. Ferris Bueller's 0 hours contract, it would be. That'd be the sequel.
Oh, God, that's depressing. Yeah.
Ferris Bueller would be heavily involved in the government shutdown right now, by the way. Yeah. You just know.
He'd
just
absolutely know. Be in the Trump White House. He's 100%.
A punchable little shit.
The John Wick trailer's just dropped.
Yes, John Wick 3 Parabellum.
Parabellum.
It's back. It was Parabellum, then it wasn't Parabellum, now it's back to being Parabellum.
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 John Wick 3.
It's almost like we rehearsed that, but we didn't.
That is absolutely mad. Let's not watch it, shall we? Let's just save that for after. Yeah. But let's just assume that it was amazing and we loved it and it's fantastic and we're very, very excited about John Wick Chapter 3. Parabellum.
Well, at least there was one trailer this week. I don't think there were any other trailers that were interested
were
in,
no,
were there? No,
there were
other
no
trailers.
Other trailers.
Can't think of anything.
There was some other casting news.
Charlotte Rampling is joining Dune, which is very exciting.
Yeah, they're Rampling the
Reverend Mother. Yeah. She who will appoint the Kwisatz Haderach.
That's right.
And for people who are normal, what is that?
Hey, this is a very mainstream book.
She's like the mother superior of the kind of magic witch priest nun people.
Yeah.
Who live on the sand planet with the wormy things.
Well, actually, they
don't. No, she doesn't.
They don't. Okay. No.
And she has determined the sort of genetic line that will lead to the birth of
the Kwisatz Haderach, which is the Messiah.
Great.
Anyway, but she'll be good.
So Charlotte Rampling. That's a very good bit of casting.
So that happened. That was good. There was some other casting news as well that Danny Glover has joined the cast of the new Jumanji film, the sequel to Welcome to the Jungle. I guess we can call it Jumanji 3 for the time being.
Cool.
And in fact, I have a theory.
Right.
Because Danny DeVito joined the cast just before Christmas.
Okay.
And so my suspicion is that this time it's a group of OAPs who get sucked into the video game world. What an acting challenge that will give The Rock and Karen Gillan and Jack Black and Kevin Hart. What an acting challenge it is for them.
That could be fun. I'm here for it.
I'm all for that. Yeah. It's going to be good. Just
also in casting, Anne Hathaway is going to lead Robert Zemeckis' remake of The Witches. Mm.
That's good.
Readaptation.
Yeah. That's good for her. I'm very happy.
What is it?
What?
Good.
I mean, she's no Angelica Houston.
That's my thing, right? Yeah. Is her performance in that film remains one of the kind of most memorable, terrifying moments of my childhood. The moment she takes off her wig and her gloves is just remarkable. I still it's burned on my brain. And can she do that level of menace and fear? We are yet to see.
I think she can. I think she's got it in her.
Do you?
Yeah, I think all those people who hate her, I think they've been sensing it all along.
Oh, they've been sensing the malevolence. Mm.
Sensing the malevolence. The Terry White story. I'm excited about that. That's good. There was some other casting news this week. I don't think it was really anything else really to talk about. But so The Many Saints of Newark, the Sopranos prequel that is co-written by David Chase and directed by the Sopranos, I guess, stalwart mainstay director Alan Taylor, he of Thor the Dark World, added some cast members. We already had Alessandro Nivola on board, and he's going to be Dickie Moltisanti, who is Christopher Moltisanti's dad, I believe. So John Bernthal, Vera Farmiga, Billy Magnussen, and Corey Stoll have all joined the cast of that movie. That's exciting, isn't it?
Wait, John Bernthal and Corey Stoll?
In the same movie, yes. Mm. I know what you're thinking. Darren Cross and The Punisher? How is that going to work?
That's what I'm thinking.
And Steven Spielberg has found his Maria.
Oh, Maria.
For West Side Story, he has cast a 17-year-old newcomer, Rachel Segler. And that's pretty much it, I think, really. I mean,
probably,
there's some other movie news. There's Aquaman made $1 billion finally at the box office. I say finally in just a few weeks.
I mean, who had Aquaman in the DC sweepstakes to beat $1 billion?
I mean, it's
amazing. Not us.
Well, Helen, if you go back to our Aquaman spoiler special.
Oh, I agree. You said it at that point once you'd seen it, but on the page.
Oh, initially?
Yeah.
No.
No, of course not.
No.
Absolutely.
Shut it down right
don't
now.
Don't do it.
No, stop it. Mm. Stop it right away. Step away from the megaphone. But they sure proved that's wrong. And it has an octopus playing bongos or drums or whatever. So, yeah, I'm all for it. All right, that's pretty much it. Should we move on to something else?
Wait, hang on.
What?
There was a Spider-Man Far From Home trailer.
Oh, that's what it is. That's what it is. There we go. Spider-Man Far From Home. It finally dropped this week. There had been rumors of this trailer since before Christmas. In fact, I think at one point it was rumored to come out the same week, the day after the trailer for Avengers Endgame. Back in early December now, I guess that was. It didn't happen, and I think I can see why it didn't happen. Because I think it would have diminished the impact somewhat of Avengers Endgame to have a Spider-Man trailer where Peter Parker, played by Tom Holland, is just walking around and living.
Not
and
blowing in the wind.
Breathing, and yes, and not being made of dust and all that stuff. All that beautiful stuff. So this is a, I thought this was a perfectly fun trailer. You see Peter Parker. There's two versions, the domestic version and the international version. Peter Parker is going on a school trip to Europe, and there he gets involved with Nick Fury and some shenanigans with some sort of water creature. And Jake Gyllenhaal shows up with his helmet as Mysterio.
Chris.
There's a lot to unpack from this trailer, and mm-hmm. people have requested that we discuss it at some length, so I think we should disappoint them.
You're a monster.
There's been a lot of timeline wrangling on Twitter about this, where people are unsure whether or not this is pre or post snap, and the fact that they're on a field trip, and obviously when we encounter Spider-Man he's on a bus, you're wondering, oh, are you returning from the field trip in Infinity War?
And of course the answer to that is no, as we know from the announcement of this film, which said it was set afterwards.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, look, it's a spoiler for Endgame. I think we just have to accept that it's a spoiler for Endgame. But basically, if anybody seriously expected half the universe to stay dead at the end of Endgame, then I'm sorry this has spoiled your fun. For the rest of us, it's not a big deal, I think. So yeah, Peter Parker is now moving on to the next stage of his life. Now, the only theory I've heard, which I thought was interesting in terms of Endgame, was the idea that half the universe has been taken into a mirror universe, where everybody dead there is alive and vice versa.
It's the leftovers.
It's like that, yes. I don't think that's the case. But if you're really concerned about spoilers and you really want to believe that this is not set after Endgame or is not a spoiler for Endgame, then that's your out from now until April. Mm-hmm. You can believe that this is in Universe B and everybody else is in Universe A. Okay? Trousers
of
Time. We're in a different leg of the Trousers of Time.
Yeah.
Well, it's not really that, is it? It's different. Like half the people are in one universe.
Trousers of Reality.
This is the crotch of Trousers of Time.
We're stuck in the gusset.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you really want to believe it isn't a spoiler, then that is your out. I'm giving it to you. Thanks to someone on Twitter who gave it to me, and I apologise, I don't remember your name.
I feel a little bit like when they announced Spider-Man Far From Home, they spoiled Infinity War Endgame, so we're fine.
I think that there was always going to be a massive marketing challenge around this, and I think everybody involved realised that. And I'd heard the other timeline theory as well, which I kind of indulged in for a bit. But yeah, as you say, the very thought that all those people would stay dead is clearly absurd. What I do think is I loved it. I thought the tone was bang on, I have to say. The last kind of 5 seconds, the effects were... I think I'd like to see more, but there was...
Finished.
But it was a little bit challenging. But, I mean, there was that line where Peter Parker says, oh, you're really pretty, to Zendaya's character. And she says, oh, because that's where my value lies. And that was just absolutely bang on.
Oh, she's hilarious. I love her.
Yeah. Isn't she just... But I thought it was a complete breath of fresh air, actually.
Yeah, he's adorable. Timeline issues-wise, apparently his passport was issued in 2016.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what that does to anything.
See,
but
I'm not ruling out that it takes place before Endgame.
Okay.
Because Ant-Man and the Wasp took place before Infinity War, but came out after Infinity War. I don't think it is going to take place before Endgame or before Infinity War, but there's a chance that it might. And maybe the passport thing might play into that, or maybe someone's just messed up again with the timelines. Who knows?
He would have had to get... Maybe didn't they have something about his passport, him having a passport for going to Germany?
I get a sneaking suspicion that Tony Stark just smuggled him into Germany
anyone. I think there's a line about it, though.
Yes,
like
he does.
Is
it get your passport?
Yeah.
Or have you?
I think there's a line about it. So actually, that's maybe just a reference to Civil War.
Okay.
I've literally just decided that right
now.
Yeah,
that's a good idea. I like that. That seems fine. But, you know, a few people have said this. I mean, you know, you're right. The very existence of this movie is a bit of a spoiler. Mm-hmm. But someone wrote into me via DM and said, do you think it takes a complaint of trailers giving too much away to a whole new level? And to which I replied, what does it give away? It gives away nothing. And if you think that the revelation of how Spider-Man, Peter Parker, comes back is going to be given away in this trailer, then you're sorely mistaken. It is not given away. All we know is that there's a Peter Parker walking around fighting something, and Mysterio seems to be helping out, which is interesting. And we haven't really talked about Mysterio.
I mean, he's got one of the weirder comics costumes. Mm. We have to acknowledge this. Like
the fishbowl on his head.
The fishbowl on his head. In fact, half a fishbowl. It's not even a full fishbowl. It's like he's wearing a flying saucer. Yeah. There's been a certain amount of, I'll call it thirst for Gyllenhaal in this costume.
I would say his helmet has caused quite the stir.
I don't think it was the helmet that was doing it, Chris. I think it was the when he wasn't wearing the helmet that was causing the thirst.
But yeah, I'm excited about this movie. I think it's going to be a nice change of tone after Endgame, which I don't expect to be a complete misery fest. I think it'll be triumphant ultimately, but it'll also have sad bits, like the bit where Captain America dies.
You're a monster!
He survives a battle with Thanos. Right. Everything's fine, and he just keels over. Very sudden, but he didn't suffer, Helen. You'd be glad to know.
This is not my headcanon. Go away.
Anything else to say about this trailer? Happy days?
I just love it. I love the chemistry that this cast has and these characters. I think Tom Holland is just marvelous. Somebody asked me who my Spider-Man was recently, you know, because like it was Tobey Maguire. I don't think Andrew Garfield, bless him, became anybody's Spider-Man really. And now, of course, we have an embarrassment of riches in both Tom Holland's live action Spider-Man and Miles Morales and Friends. But he's really just nailed this character. I love him.
Controversially, I preferred Andrew Garfield's Peter Parker to Tobey Maguire's.
Good Lord. Wow, that's one. Yeah. I mean, look, I love Andrew Garfield. I think he's great. I think the chemistry he had with Emma Stone was great, which was why their storytelling decision in the second one was so bad.
There were many storytelling decisions in the second one.
But the death, yeah.
Yeah. And let's move on from movie news, and that's indeed Welcome a Guest. Should we have a guest? Let's have a guest. Now, last week, at the end of last week's show, we trailed Charlie Brooker as a guest, but clearly he decided to go full Bandersnatch and choose the scheduling clash means you can't actually do the Empire podcast option. I hope this worked out for him. Good luck with your career, Charlie Brooker, I say. But we do have another guest, and that other guest is awesome. He is Adam McKay. He is the writer and director of some of my favourite comedies of the last few years. And James is as well. James loves everything Adam McKay has ever done.
Oh, love the Anchor Ball.
Yeah, right. Anchor Ball, yeah. Anchorman.
Dodge Man.
James just Dodge. Loves comedy generally, don't you?
Anchorman, the legend of Ron Burgundy. Anchorman 2, the legend continues. Talladega Nights, the ballad of Ricky Bobby. Step Brothers, it's the fucking Catalina wine mixer. The Other Guys. And then, of course, he switched tack a few years ago to a slightly more serious film, a more politically aware film. He's very politically aware, very politically astute, very active guy, Adam McKay. And he won a bloody Oscar. Only went and won a bloody Oscar with a screenplay for The Big Short. And next week's film, Vice, which tells the tale of how Dick Cheney emerged from humble beginnings to become possibly the most powerful man in the world. It ploughs a similar furrow of politically active, very, very razor-sharp comedy that plays fast and loose with stylistic templates. It's a really interesting film, and McKay is a really interesting guy, and he came in to talk to me recently at a London hotel, and we talked about all sorts of things, from Dick Cheney to McKay's very own, very recent, and all too real health scare on the movie. Enjoy.
Check, check, check.
That'll be fine.
Excellent.
Let's get a level from you, get a level from me.
Check, check, check. I am speaking words. Human beings have formed words.
How many times when you're doing this stuff do people say the human torch was denied a bank loan? Does that happen a lot?
The human torch was denied a bank loan. You know what? Not recently.
just nerds like me.
It's been quite a while. It's been about 10 years since I've heard that. And I got to tell you, I enjoy it.
I enjoyed it.
Actually, one of my favorite ones is from Anchorman 2, where he screams like, ah, someone's in the house. Save the children. And that's his vocal warm-up. That one may make me laugh the hardest. Yeah.
I mean, you've won an Oscar since. Should we just start? Do a big introduction, but I think we've kind of started. You've won an Oscar since last we spoke, but I said this to you before, you should have won one for Dobie for Best Original Song. It, you know, the Oscars screwed you guys. I'm glad they made it up to you for The Big Short.
Yeah, my God, I love Dobie. There are a couple runs in that movie that are as delicious as anything we've ever done. Mm. And Dobie, him blind in that lighthouse, being the worst blind guy ever. And also them discovering trash news.
Yes.
With this kind of exuberance. Like, yes. Why do we have to tell them what they need to hear? Let's just tell them what they want to hear. That run, too, I just love. Yeah.
I wanted to start off by saying, by welcoming you to the show.
Thank you.
I believe it's actually, we're lucky to have you.
Well, I guess in some ways, yeah. I had a little bit of a heart scare on Vice. I'm one of those extremely intelligent gentlemen who decided to smoke for about 30 years. And while everyone told me it was going to kill me, and I said, poo-poo.
Yeah, I'm dead.
I'm the exception. So when Vice was over, I was working out with my trainer and I had a very serious heart scare. I had
tingly hands but I didn't have chest pain or arm pain.
Right.
So I told my trainer, I go, I'm fine. It's just tingly and I feel a little queasy. So I convinced my trainer to leave. And then right in that moment that I was sitting alone on the couch, I remembered Christian Bale telling me when we filmed the Dick Cheney heart attack scenes,
yeah,
how do you want me to do the heart attack? There's a lot of ways you can have heart attacks. And I was like, what are you talking about? I thought it's the arm and the chest. He goes, no. One of the more common ways is your stomach gets queasy and you feel sick to your stomach. And right at that moment, I jumped up and ran upstairs and popped about 4 baby aspirins and called my wife, who then called 911. And I got to the hospital and the doctor was like, why did you do that? Like, you, there's no damage to your heart because you got in here so fast. He's like, you were having a heart attack, but you did what you're supposed to do. And I was like, my lead actor, I think it was either Christian Bale or Dick Cheney, just saved my life. That's no exaggeration. That actually happened. Yeah. Yeah. And I called Bale about a week later. And of course, he's a sweet guy. He's like, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? And I'm like, no, honestly, I'm good. But I think you saved my life. And we just laughed.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was a crazy, crazy story.
I'm glad to hear you're okay. Has that prompted a major lifestyle change? Smoking's
the big one was
the
no
head.
More smoking. Yeah. I tell you, nothing will get you over that than looking at the roof of an ambulance while you're going 90 miles an hour down Wilshire. That was it. It was over.
Is the heroin completely out for you now?
No. Yeah. I can manage that.
just weekends, occasional weekends.
That's it. That's
and the odd day.
Yeah, and holidays and every day.
During podcasts. Sort of thing. I'm so glad you're okay. And there's a wonderful thread that goes throughout the film. I don't want to spoil too much of the film for people who haven't seen it yet, obviously. But there is a thread that runs throughout the film where Dick Cheney does have heart attacks in the most wonderfully matter-of-fact way. And how much of that it was derived from truth? Because, again, there's a thing at the beginning of the movie where you go, this is a very inscrutable subject, and finding out the truth about Dick Cheney and what went down is difficult, but we tried.
We tried. Yeah, he is a character who has done, he's a real person who has done everything he can to make sure that no one tells his story. I mean, his autobiography is like a court deposition. It's so boring. And there's no breadcrumbs. Not only are there no breadcrumbs, there's no path. But, you know, God bless the many, many incredible journalists out there who have written articles, books, interviews. And oddly enough, his wife wrote an autobiography that was incredibly helpful. So we dug in to all of that. We hired our own journalists who interviewed people from his world, all off the record, of course, just to make sure we weren't crazy people with the conclusions we were drawing. And it was a little bit like a mystery, the whole thing. And then when you're going to really dive into a character, who do you call but Christian Bale? And then you call Amy Adams and the cast we had, and they all dove right in there with me. And the whole movie was kind of driven by this idea of, like, who was this guy that changed world history? I mean, like, without exaggeration, you know, changed the direction of human history. And yet all we know about him is he shot a guy in the face and, you know, Bush was silly and it seemed like he was doing stuff. I mean, that's kind of what most people knew about him. So it was an exciting process. And part of that was his heart trouble. And he had a lot of heart attacks. We actually, there's one heart attack that's not even in there because there were so many. But during the 70s, he was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day and eating a dozen donuts a day.
Oh, that'll do it.
In the Ford White House. That'll do it. That'll get you there. But he's a tough cuss, man. He comes from, you know, Wyoming, the 1950s, hard, hard people. And he would have the heart attacks and take a little bit of a beat and then just come right back over and over again.
It's darkly hilarious, the heart attacks. So just the matter-of-fact way that Bale plays them.
He plays, oh my God, he kills me the way he plays it.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And his performance, I mean, Jesus.
is Christian Bale actually under there? Is that
we joke that,
dark magic?
Christian Bale is actually played by a guy named Dan Belmont, who's from South Carolina, who goes about 165. He's a redhead, and he plays Christian Bale, who then plays the characters. No, I've never seen anything like it. I really haven't. I mean, I guess, you know, if you're David O. Russell on The Fighter, that was another one where it was like, holy moly. But when he finally dialed in the physical transformation, the weight gain, the all the mannerisms, the layers and layers of psychological research he does. I mean, people talk about the physical transformation, but honest to God, the like the psychological, the tics, the movements are even more impressive. And I'll never forget the day where everything lined up, the makeup, the work.
Yeah,
and I remember getting chills in my arm as he walked down the hallway with the Cheney walk. And
that's how it was, chills. Otherwise, it's more baby aspirin and off to the hospital for you.
Exactly.
I'm getting these chills on my arm.
It was good chills. It definitely was. Yeah.
Did it happen on The Big Short? Were you looking at him? Were you thinking of Cheney already? And were you looking at Christian Bale and thinking, that's my guy?
You know, I wasn't thinking it during The Big Short. I was thinking, oh my God, where did this guy come from? And where did this whole great cast come from? But, you know, he had one of the trickiest characters in there because it was a guy, Michael Burry, who lives his life in an interior way. He's a guy who's not looking for the spotlight. He's a guy who's not looking to be charming. And I think Christian and I found that really exciting. These characters, you know, to go to even a bigger view of the whole thing, there are so many stories nowadays in the modern world that aren't classical Joseph Campbell stories. They're these stories that are in between the stories. And they're really more and more the ones that are kind of shaping the way we live our lives. And Dick Cheney is one of those guys. He's a guy who never wanted his story to fit a three-act structure. You know, Sid Field, McKee, those guys would be like, God, what do you do with this guy? And and precisely because of that is why Christian was excited. And precisely because of that is why I thought of Christian. I thought if anyone can go into these challenging, rocky, you know, ankle high waters and find something worthwhile, it's going to be Christian Bale.
Yeah. How involved were you during the development process of that character? Do you basically give Christian his head? You say, go away, forge the character, do what you need to do to get the headspace, come back in for rehearsal and we'll see where you are? Or do you check up with him every day? Do you see the performance taking shape?
We had a bunch of meetings at his house, about three or four, because I had done so much research. I mean, more research than was probably healthy. And I knew a lot about Dick Cheney. So we would just sit and Christian would ask me questions and questions and questions. And I would tell him what I was thinking. And then he would tell me something else. And we did this a bunch of times. And I kept telling him, I was like, ignore me if you need to. But this is what I've found. And then at one point he did ignore me. And then at one point he went and dove into his own process very in an incredibly deep and personal way for, God, like a good couple months. And then as he started coming out of his own personal process, he came back to me.
Okay.
And he would have certain things that he was like, yeah, you were right about this. This is interesting. Or, you know what? You said this, but I found this. So we kind of reconnected on the back end.
You're a very politically active guy, as anyone who knows your work or indeed follows you on Twitter will know. You and Will did the Bush Broadway show a few years ago, so you're clearly very aware of who Cheney was and how he worked within that power structure. But what point did you think, you know what, I want to skewer this guy. I want to nail him to the wall.
Well, you know, we always knew that Cheney was a powerful force. I think kind of in a very pop culture way, a lot of people would joke that he was pulling the puppet strings.
Yeah, he's a very Machiavellian figure. It's very easy to poke fun at.
Yeah, yeah. And we looked at those kinds of characters from history. We looked at, you know, Talleyrand and all these kind of characters who would be in the back shadows. And what I really decided was not that I want to nail him to the wall, but I want to understand what the human being here is. Mm-hmm. And really a lot of the effort was, who are these people that are doing this? Who are these people that are changing history? Who are these people that are making these decisions behind closed doors that are affecting our lives? And we obviously encountered it with the bankers in The Big Short. And I would have asked the same. And we did have the same question, like, who are these banking CEOs that, how do you stare at the carnage of those decisions? And how are you raised? And who are you? And how do you manage this? And so really the goal with Cheney, and I have some friends who are very far on the left who are a little bit like, really, you're going to humanize this guy? And I just felt like it's the only way to go. I think, like, if we just call people heroes or villains or good or bad, it accomplishes nothing. People are complicated. You know, I believe basically we're good, and we get to these kind of twisted, turned around places through interesting stories. So that's kind of what we went after.
Is that something that you discovered as you went along, that, you know, not completely humanized, not to make him entirely sympathetic, but to find some grace notes?
I think those moments where I started seeing his humanity, and I really, I don't know if I was surprised, but it was important that he accepted his daughter when she came out of the closet so quickly, and he embraced her so wholeheartedly. And you really saw a lot of moments of humanity from him, especially early on. And the people we talked to would always tell you, a great sense of humor. He cooks dinner for his family every night. He does all the shopping. And there was a warmth. There was a father there. And a lot of other people would tell you he really cared about the country and thought that he was a servant for the country. A lot of these stories were from the early days, from the 70s and the 80s. And then these same people would tell you that something changed coming into the W. Bush years. And that was really it. That was the question. What changed? Mm. I mean, I had a crazy lunch. God, how long ago was this? I think it was when Will and I were doing the George W. Bush one-man show on Broadway, You're Welcome, America. Mm. And we got a call that Bill Clinton wanted to have lunch with us up at his office in Harlem. And so, of course, we're like, yes, we'll be there. And I expected it to be like 12 people at a big lunch table, but it wasn't. It was just Bill Clinton, Farrell, myself, and then like an assistant kind of seated two seats away from us. And we talked about a lot of things, but I don't know why. Once again, it goes back to my fascination with Cheney. I just said, what's the deal with Dick Cheney? And Clinton told me a story that Cheney called him after Clinton had his heart attack. And there was actually a little bit of warmth and like, are you doing okay? And then he said, you know, in the middle of conversation, it was just like everything got, it was like Cheney realized what he was doing and everything just got very cold. And very quickly he was off the phone. And then I asked Clinton, I said, what do you think changed about him? And Clinton kind of got a faraway look in his eyes and was like, I don't know. And I was like, do you think it was the heart attacks? And he really was like, I don't know. But the consensus seemed to be that something changed about this guy. And my conclusion was that he was always a guy seeking power. He was always a guy who was a little bit paranoid. But then when 9/11 hit, it just jacked everything times 10. So that's the way we portray it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that key question, I mean, I'm definitely open to someone telling me we didn't get it right. But mm-hmm. I think we did. Mm. It felt right to me.
There seems to be a lot of anger in this movie. A lot of anger about the way the world is now.
Sure.
A lot of anger about the way that the decisions made back then have led to the world being the way it is now. Is that fair to say? Are you angry about the state of the world, Adam? Or
you know, I think it's more, I'm incredulous. Yeah. I think it's more that the whole experience of the last 20 years has been one of like, I was joking with someone the other day that you could call The Big Short and Vice and whatever the third movie I'm going to do after this, you could call it the What the Holy F Happened trilogy. And I don't know, man. I mean, maybe this is just, I'm 50 years old now. And when you get older, you just sound like a cranky old man. But call me nuts, man. But having like a, you know, an orange reality star as our president. And, you know, we have to like, I just read something that like, 49% of Americans don't even know we're still at war in Afghanistan. Like, there's every day this cascade of craziness and just upside down kind of nature to civilization. And I know you guys are seeing it over here in the UK, mm-hmm. and I know we're seeing it in Poland and Hungary and Venezuela and the Philippines and Russia. And yeah, it seems like civilization got kind of exhausted. So is it anger? Yeah, a little bit, but I think it's just shock that sometimes drifts into anger and like, hey, has anyone noticed this? and then a lot of times sadness. I mean, I think that, you know, this movie too, really in the end strikes me every time I watch the ending, I get very sad.
There are moments in this film, Trump appears very, very briefly. There's an archive shot of Trump. I imagine you debated long and hard about including that or including more Trump.
We had a lot of discussions about that. Yeah. And he pops up in the 80s. And my editor, the great Hank Corwin, and I decided that that's where he belongs. He was an 80s celebrity. He was part of that kind of cartoonish period. And that's where you should see him. Mm-hmm. So beyond that, we decided not to show him, not to talk about him. But that felt like his place in history. And I don't view him as a decision-making force in the world right now. He is definitely a symptom. He's, if you get a boil, you don't go, oh my God, why is this boil doing this to me? It's like, no, the boil comes from something. Or if, you know, if you get poison ivy in your ear, you don't get mad at your ear. It's
maybe we should fuck you ear.
I'm not sure that metaphor works at all, but
I'll take it.
Yeah, we just felt like I'm not gonna get into that. I mean, there's clearly bigger problems afoot.
I am fascinated by the evolution of your technique because this is I'd say very much the visual and editing style of The Big Short, but pushed even further. I don't want to give too much away, but there are stylistic digressions throughout the film that really tickled me, that really surprised me. You play with the form, you play with narrative, you play with the timelines. Where did that come from for you? Because I guess you could say that both Anchorman movies are maybe not beholden to three-act structure either, that, you know. Mm-hmm. But with The Big Short and with this movie, it does feel very fractured and fragmented, which is a very deliberate thing. It feels like you're pushing the form in an interesting way.
You know, we talked about this a lot. With The Big Short, it naturally came out of that kind of... Oh, wait. Sorry.
You're right.
One second. I have... I don't want to get too personal. I have hemorrhoids.
Oh, okay. I will cut that bit out. Don't worry.
No, leave that in. I insist. In fact, I'm going to say that with pride. I have hemorrhoids.
Should we just do what people of a certain age do and just exchange our medical information?
Oh, my God. I know. I'm a bit of a mess. A bit of a mess of late, although getting better.
Oh, good.
You know, I think with The Big Short, it came out of the fact that there was this irrational exuberance to the economy that just lent itself to this kind of frenetic, crazed, kind of rolling down a hill kind of style. And then I think what we started seeing, and I would include the TV show Succession in
this. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I was lucky enough to get to work with on with Jesse Armstrong. I got to direct the pilot and, you know, help with the casting and the style. And we talked about it a lot with Succession as well, where what is the tone of today and where does comedy live today and what is funny and what is tragic and what is the narrative? And it just feels like we're in a time where these things can be questioned and in a exciting way and kind of a, you know, an upsetting way as well. So I, you know, we worked on Succession, I was working on Vice, and all of it just felt like, no, we should push the tone. We should push the narrative. I think you can have really dark tragedy living next to absurd comedy. And it's just felt like what we were going through in the world right now. And at the same time, also, we were clearly kind of driving into kind of unknown territory. I mean, it was definitely a lot of fog or snow blinding our windshield as we went in with Succession. I mean, Jesse and I would joke about it. Like, I would be like, this is really dark, but at the same time, it's really making me laugh.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the vulnerability of the characters, I actually oddly care about them, but I'm not sure your general public will. And so we talked a lot about, like, Neil LaBute was really a guy who I felt like was on that tip very early in the Company of Men, Friends and Neighbors. And we looked at, or do you remember a movie, Man Bites Dog?
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, those kinds of movies. Another one of my favorite, Mail Order Wife by Andrew Gerlin, where you have this dark reality mixed with this absurdist comedy. And I guess when you see like the supposed leader of your country after the northern part of your state is totally burned down, mm-hmm. and he's giving a speech about raking the woods, mm-hmm. and how we need to rake the woods, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, that's really funny, but really upsetting at the same time. And we just keep having moments like those over and over again. So yeah, I just gave you a very long-winded answer. I think my answer is like, we don't entirely know either, but we know things are changing and we just kind of jumped into the breach.
It feels like reality is outpacing satire at the moment. It just...
I mean, that's it, right? Yeah,
it's as fast as you can write this stuff, he's writing it faster.
I just never knew the disintegration of modern civilization would be so ludicrous. I never knew it would play like a bad early 80s. I never knew it would play like Small Wonder. But it is.
Yeah.
It is.
Feels like we're all Slim Pickens. We're all riding a nuclear bomb on the way down.
By the way, that image may sum it all up. Yeah. Yeah,
I want to ask about how this new narrative approach from a filmmaking point of view plays out in your scripts.
Well, you know, the initial approach to the movie was, we're going to treat this movie like it's Giant. We're going to treat this movie like it's Citizen Kane, like it's Reds, like it's the big, giant, epic American story, or Last Picture Show is another one we talked about. And we just talked about scope and vistas. And at the same time, we also know that, you know, storytelling's changing. There's, you know, millions and millions of videos on phones and mm-hmm. streaming and movies, and audiences are crazily sophisticated now. I mean, it's amazing what you can get away with. Like a movie like Cabin in the Woods, like 25 years ago, would have been like, you know, some German art film. And now audiences are right with it. And you know, Get Out. And there's just so many cool, interesting things. Sorry to Bother You, I thought was like a really exciting, interesting movie.
First film, debut film, and he's pushing it in that direction.
100%. I that movie blew me away.
His confidence, my God.
Oh, I can't wait to see what he does next. I saw him recently. I was like, man, anything you need, I will do craft service for you. So yeah, we're in this zone where, like I said before, you know, in a way, the power forms have adapted. They're not going to let us do Joseph Campbell stories about them anymore. It's not going to be a simple hero's journey. They become more complicated. They're dodging us. They're mirroring us. They're pretending they're the hero's journey. And you know what? Billionaires, they're on a tough road because they have all this money and they're supposed to feel bad about it, but God darn it, they earned it. And maybe they're the hero. And you go, wait a minute, that didn't seem right. They inherited the money. And so there's this kind of, I'm reminded of the stories from Vietnam, supposedly, where they would leave landmines and then the enemy would come and flip all the landmines to off. And then the US soldiers would come back and flip them to on. And then the enemies wouldn't flip them, expecting the U.S. to think they had. And it's like this back and forth. And I think that's kind of going on with the storytelling ground.
That's
I mean, let's face it. That's where most of this battle exists, is with mythology, with belief, with storytelling. Once again, incredibly long-witted answer. Maybe a little self-important, too.
You know what? It's a podcast, man. If we can get away with it, we can get away with long-winded. We can certainly get away with self-important.
Let's go back to Dobie.
Oh, Dobie.
Oh,
Dobie.
He bottle-fed that shark.
What is next for you? You mentioned that you might have a third part of this What the Fuck trilogy up your sleeve.
Well, you know, sadly, the big ball of reality that's just the big Howl's Moving Castle of reality that's coming over the horizon line is global warming, man. It's just, I wish it wasn't the case. There are other more enjoyable stories I'd rather tell, but I'm going to see if I can crack something with that. At the same time, you know, I don't know. It'd be fun to go back to a rip-roaring comedy. I miss laughing with Will Ferrell on set all day. So he and I are kicking some stuff around. I have learned through the years, never predict what movie you're going to do next while you're still taking out your new movie, because I've always been wrong. But somewhere in that zone, I mean, if I could think of a global warming absurdist comedy with Will Ferrell and John
That's
C. Reilly,
that would be
that would make me very happy. But I'm not sure. Yeah.
Step Brothers 2 just took a whole new direction.
believe me, it crossed my mind. It crossed my mind.
That is interesting because I've been musing about this for a while, about Hollywood's responsibility to not lecture people, but to inform people about global warming. Because a lot of people have shut their ears to the whole thing. And
sure.
Do you think that Hollywood has a responsibility? That it's very important. It reaches millions of people in a way that they don't really listen to politicians.
I think, you know, any decent storyteller, whether it's movies, music, novels, whatever, you can't ignore reality. I think that's just what it's about. And, you know, if all of a sudden the entire world became infested with lemurs, and there were lemurs like living in apartment buildings, climbing in trees, howling, shrieking, throwing their poop at us every single day. And then I did it, you know, a movie where there were no lemurs. You'd go, how do you not have lemurs? Like, you know, just a terrible example. I apologize. Once
this
again,
is like
go back
the
to
fourth
Dolby.
Bad analogy. This
so
is...
There's some really bad analogies coming the way. Although now I kind of like it. Now it's growing on me.
Yeah.
So I feel like with climate change, it's the same thing, man. This is mammoth. I mean, it is gigantic. And to ignore it just feels like, you know, it just feels like you're shooting Novocaine into your brain. It just feels wrong when I watch things that, you know, don't at least somewhat address that. And, you know, Jesse Armstrong and I have talked about this for Succession. Like, you know, it's you want the show to deal with reality, yet you don't want reality to be steering the show. Mm-hmm. You just want to acknowledge what the topography of the physical world is and where we're at. So it's always a tricky thing because, like you said, it can become preachy. It can become hectoring, and you never want to do that. You know, that's part of the reason that we screw around with this forum. And I think laughter has to be a part of it. I think there can be all kinds of different feelings. You can be afraid, you can be confused, you can be interested. And but whenever it becomes a wagging finger, you're in a little bit of trouble.
Well, it was announced this week that Will is returning as Ron Burgundy for a podcast. Are you involved with that, or is that...
I'm actually not. I'm involved with it in the sense that I could not be happier. No, he had mentioned it to me. I was like, oh, my friend, please give me that. And now that you mention it, I will make sure one of the podcasts opens with the Dobie song. That has to happen. Yeah.
It has to. He touched us all with his expressionless face.
He does.
He really does. Adam McKay, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much indeed.
Always a pleasure. So good to see you, man.
Okay, so that was Adam McKay. We will be reviewing Vice on next week's show, but now we come to the movie reviews portion of this week's show. How exciting. We're going to be tackling three films of such lethal cunning. No?
No.
I'm trying to get that catchphrase off the ground. Doesn't work. Oh, well. Back to the drawing board. Let's start off by talking about M. Night Shyamalan's Glass, which is, of course, a sequel to his most recent thriller hit, Split, which turned out to be a stealth sequel to Unbreakable, his 2000, and I'm going to use this word, masterpiece?
Ooh, fair.
His best film, I would say, in which Bruce Willis's David Dunn was revealed to be a superhero and indeed had a supervillain nemesis played by Samuel L. Jackson. And when that was revealed, I lost my shit. Because I love Unbreakable, and I've been wanting an Unbreakable sequel for many, many years. I never thought it was going to happen, but now we have one. And we have an Unbreakable sequel and a split sequel in the shape of Glass, which brings Bruce Willis's David Dunn, brings Samuel L. Jackson's Elijah Price, a.k.a. Mr. Glass, and brings James McAvoy's Kevin Wendell Crumb, a.k.a. so many characters. I can't even begin to list them here. And does interesting things with them, shall we say. Before we get into the film, here's a little clip.
David Dunn, you believe you are exceptionally strong, but there are men who are as strong as you. Kevin Wendell Crumb, you believe there are 24 souls living in that body with you.
You can call me Norma.
I'm so amped!
Elijah Price, you have an extraordinary IQ. You think you are superhuman. What if I suggested that you are mistaken?
They've been lying to us all.
All right, so that was a clip from Glass, and now let's get into Glass. Glass, Who gives a shit about Glass?
Well, I certainly did when I went to see this. Love Unbreakable to bits, and this picks up 19 years after that film, with David Dunn has been keeping Philadelphia safe as he's been nicknamed by the public the Overseer, the super strong, indestructible vigilante. Meanwhile, Kevin Wendell Crumb, who we last saw in Split, is still abducting young ladies, and the two of them come together, and then...
Not in a sex way.
Well, a bit in a sex way. No, not in a sex way. And then this goes in, shall we say, an unexpected direction. You'll see this from the trailer, but they are, shall we say, put together with Mr. Glass in a an institutional setting, and M. Night Shyamalan then delivers, if I'm honest, from my point of view, a film that no one really asked for. This is a very talky film, and it tries to double...
Don't like words,
like action. Actions speak louder than words, but what I really liked about Unbreakable is actually the character beats. Mm. I like that it's slow. I like it's textured. It's rich. It's very, very slow moving. It's very gradual in its revelation. And I think he tried to embrace that here. But the character beats here, I found, just didn't hit home in the same way. I think James McAvoy, as he was in Split, is superb in this. He plays, you know, two dozen characters, and he does them all brilliantly. It's a tour de force performance from him. Samuel L. Jackson, to my mind, has not enough to do. Mm. And Bruce Willis has almost nothing to do.
Yep.
And so you have a film where you're not getting what you want from it for the first two thirds. And then the last third puts the arse in Glass. It's just dreadful. I mean, this film drives off a cliff in the third act. And I was absolutely mortified by it, because this is one of the films I was most looking forward to this year. And I think that final act really just, I was bereft.
Yeah, I think he tries to do something really, really interesting with, you know, so he basically puts them all in this psychiatric institute and has Sarah Paulson going, no, you're all deluded. Like, you don't have superpowers, you just have problems, and this is how you're dealing with them. And that's a really interesting way to come at it, because it was always a very grounded superhero movie. These people are not necessarily superhuman. There's always been that little bit of wiggle room. So that was a really, really interesting take. And then it just falls apart again. And James, you're totally right. Like, the character moment and the character weight isn't there to make that movie work, and then to make this last act have any sort of meaning. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff in it. There's so many interesting ideas in it. But it just doesn't go where it... I don't know. It just doesn't go.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. It's a real shame. It's a real missed opportunity, especially since we've been waiting two decades to see Unbreakable continued. And this is what I was saying about earlier. It's like now I will forever see David Dunn. And when I'm watching Unbreakable, I will see David Dunn in it and be annoyed.
I loved the setup, the idea. And the first kind of 20 minutes, I was kind of there with it. And Helen's completely right. There is some interesting kind of thematic stuff and things about group psychoses. And all of those things are kind of really fascinating, but it unravels so quickly. It's chaotic and not in a good way. You can have structured chaos in really great films. There was no structured chaos. It was just chaos and noise. James is right. The dialogue was like, there was so much dialogue, but it wasn't great dialogue. And actually the tension between it being part Split sequel, part Unbreakable sequel, that tension never resolved itself. Mm. It started to do really interesting things in terms of what are the tropes of superhero movies and how can we subvert them and append them. As a fan of superhero films, without giving anything away, you end up disappointed at the appending of those tropes. So moments are anticlimactic, and they are obtusely and deliberately anticlimactic because it's a filmmaking choice. Mm-hmm. But as a paying audience member, it's not what I wanted to see. I think McAvoy is phenomenal. It's a masterclass. It's a McAvoy masterclass. Like, honestly, yeah. I find him completely compelling. He held the entire thing together. But I mean, never has Bruce Willis been more wasted.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I think the problem is that Knight fell in love with McAvoy as well and just gave him so much of the screen time and presumably cut down on everybody else to make room for it. Because if there was this little on the page, I don't understand why they'd be there.
It's such a showy character, the Horde, Kevin Wendell Crumb and his various personae, that it becomes easy just to give him all the stuff to do. And McAvoy's amazing. Yeah. He would transform between characters literally in one shot, and I think he was phenomenal in Split as well. And it's one of those movies that the Oscar cognoscenti look down their noses at. But honestly, he should have been in the conversation for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor.
And all of the places in Best Supporting
and
Actor.
And Best Supporting Actress.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Give him everything.
Yeah, and again, without giving too much away, I think Knight falls into the same trap on a number of occasions throughout his career, where early on he became known as a filmmaker who can do a sting like no other. He can do a twist. And you get the impression now that he's become such a slave to that, that he structures entire films around a clever ending without thinking about making the rest of the film entertaining. And it's just like this, it feels like where he wanted to go with this was ill-conceived from the get-go. And I think Terry's right, it begins really well. The first sort of like 15, 20 minutes are almost, that's the film I wanted to see.
But that's the thing, it's the trap you can fall into of you're disappointed at the film because it's not the film you wanted to see. I get that, but we have to review the film it is. Problem is, the film it is isn't very good. Yeah. But it is, it's true. I think he is deliberately giving people a little carrot with the first 20 minutes, which is fairly conventional. And it is, you know, David Dunn and Kevin Wendell Crumb, and, you know, that's not giving too much away, that they meet and there's a conflict and it's cool and you're going, yes. And then the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest style second, it's not, well, I guess the second act, some of that works as well. There's some really interesting stuff with dunderheaded security guards. I mean, the security in this place is terrible, and they should all be fired immediately. But you're waiting for the ticking time bomb of Elijah to come to fruition. But in that, you're right, David Dunn is buried, and I'm really disappointed with that because, you know, I'm a huge Bruce Willis fan, as I think we all are, and, you know, he's been trapped in a sort of DTV hell over the last few years, making some truly questionable movies. And the opportunities have been rare for a director to actually challenge him or a piece of material to challenge him, and I thought that was going to happen this time around, but it's almost like he only had 5 or 6 days available.
It's not good, you know, when you come out of a Bruce Willis film and you think, you know what, that's no Striking Distance.
Love Striking Distance.
But,
yeah.
But
Sarah Jessica Parker's finest moment on screen.
Okay, should dig into that another time. But yeah, I'd say the first 20 minutes is great. The next hour and a half or so is okay, and the last 20 minutes screws the pooch in an almost heroic fashion. But perhaps it might be one of those things where we look back at it in a few years' time and it clicks into place what he was going for, which I think a lot of people found with Unbreakable.
Yeah.
But I loved Unbreakable at the time, so.
You know. I came out of that and didn't thought it was a revelation.
Yeah, but anyway. Three stars for Glass. I know it may not sound like it around the table, but 3 stars for Glass. Next up, we have Beautiful Boy, in which Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet star as a father who fears that he is losing his son, and in fact he is losing his son, to addiction to crystal meth. Here is a clip.
I've been doing some research.
Been doing fucking research? You gotta be kidding me, Dad.
You think that you have this under control.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand how scared you are.
I understand why I do things. It doesn't make me any different, all right? I'm attracted to craziness, and you're just embarrassed because I was like, you know, I was like this amazing thing, like your special creation or something, and you don't like who I am now.
Yeah, who are you, Nick?
This is me, Dad. Here, this is who I am.
All right, so that was Timothée Chalamet going head-to-head with Steve Carell. Terry, what do we make of this film?
So, in many respects, this is kind of a traditional addiction tale. It is the story of a nice middle-class white boy played by Timothy Chalamet, who plays Nick Sheff, and his father played by Steve Carell, and what happens to their relationship and the wider family relationship when he gets lost in addiction. Now, it's based on 2 memoirs, one by the father, so he's actually a journalist for Rolling Stone and New York Times, and his son, and it's kind of a meeting of those 2 memoirs. Now, this was kind of touted for quite a while as being awards fodder, of being maybe kind of Timothée's best performance. I was left quite underwhelmed by this. I think it was quite unsatisfying from a storytelling perspective. So I think there is absolutely a valid conversation around what does addiction in a privileged situation look like? I think, what does it look like when you are a middle-class boy who has money at your disposal? There's never any sense in this film that he works for his money, that he struggles to get money. But what it is really great at is it really examines the kind of consequences on the wider family, from his kind of half-brothers and sisters to his dad's marriage. He's married for a second time to Maura Tierney, who is amazing in this film. I have to say, she's the real standout for me. You never really get your fingers around why. What are the pressures? What are the distinct pressures to being in that scenario that would lead to that addiction? I personally found some of the drug scenes, especially the scenes of him shooting up, I found them far too graphic. There was a pairing of those graphic scenes of him using drugs paired with a certain score that I felt really romanticized it. I understand that you've got to show why he would fall so deeply for this drug, but I think it crossed a line for me. And some of the emotional punch just wasn't there. And I think because it was based on two memoirs, you had not necessarily a conflicting point of view, but it shifts in the middle of the film from being kind of his father's story to being his. But there's no real difference, really, in their perspectives. I felt their performances were a little bit underwhelming. So I think addiction and recovery films are really difficult because there's how you feel about AA, kind of all the bigger debates around addiction and what you should show on screen and all of that stuff. So I think they're really tricky. But this one left me feeling a little bit cold.
Well, I have to say, I really liked it. I mean, and like is the wrong word completely, because it's a really tough watch. It's one of those films where even if you want to recommend it to someone, you kind of have to go, but like, you know, it's incredibly depressing and sad for most of the running time, because it is looking at someone who's at a father who has completely lost his son, and a guy who not only has one focus in life and will do anything for that focus, even though it's killing him. And he's kind of aware of that, even in the sort of indestructibility of his youth. I think he's aware of that on some level. And It's really, really upsetting. I thought Carell was brilliant, actually. I thought he was incredibly good. The opening scene is him going to a doctor, a specialist in addiction, and essentially saying, my son is addicted to meth. I believe that's bad. Please tell me how bad. And it's just destroyed me pretty much from start to finish. So I think it is really good at showing the effects of addiction on a family and the effects beyond the one person whose life is being ruined by his or her own actions. It's also showing all the lives around them and how they're affected, and how this really loving son and brother is suddenly, like, literally stealing from his baby sister's piggy bank. I mean, really sort of pathetic desperation. And that I thought was quite, again, just quite, it's obviously not as much of a misery fest as some drug addiction dramas by any means, because as you say, they're a very comfortably off, very privileged family. But that almost allows you to focus a bit more on the emotional strain that it's putting on them, because it's not just about everything. It's not everything piling up on them at once.
It's interesting because, yeah, I guess we don't want to be glib about this in any way, shape or form, but Timothée Chalamet looks like Timothée Chalamet all the way through this movie. And, you know, I'm no expert on this sort of stuff, but from Breaking Bad, which has taught me everything I need to know about meth addiction, I expected there to be a bit more of a physical decline.
He gets very skinny.
But there's a Beautiful and the Damned out of this. There's a scene where he literally goes, this poet saved my life so many times, and he starts to read Charles Bukowski. And I think that whole, as I say, romanticised kind of... And I don't mind him being middle class and being comfortable,
But that's such a disaffected teenage boy cliche. Yeah. I think it almost, like, shows the banality of his problems.
And there's a scene where his dad references it and goes, you know, there will be one day when you don't read these writers who you think understand how alienated you are. But then the Bukowski scene comes up and a girl looks him across the room, really, you know, and falls in love with him at that moment. But I think that the fact that they were comfortable and therefore you did expect more from the emotional side of it, I think that's why I felt so underwhelmed, because there wasn't any other drama going on. It was very much about his drugs. And like you're saying, Chris, I didn't really see or feel any huge consequences of his drug use. So the scene where, yeah, he steals and then kind of he goes missing for a bit. But there was something quite surface to the whole thing for me, which felt like I really didn't believe in the ultimate emotional and physical disintegration that goes on with heavy meth users. That really does go on with heavy meth
users. We wanted more degradation. That's what we wanted, Helen. We wanted to see people's arms fall off, which I understand is a side effect.
Well, Chris, I mean, given that you're an expert on meth, having watched Breaking Bad, I'm sure you would know.
Twice.
Oh, hang on. Steady on. I just thought it was... I thought Carell basically slayed me. I'm a sucker for, you know, parent and child kind of tragic tragedies. So this really worked for me.
I'm with you on the opening scene, though. That was... I found that scene probably one of the most affecting in it. You know, and I understand that kind of part of the familial problem is you have to emotionally cut yourself off. And some of that obviously comes through in his performance. But the power lessened for me as the film went on.
again, it seems childish to say this, but it's a real life story, and it obviously happened, and they suffered tragedy together and as a family. But it was a bit repetitive as well. As a movie, a bit repetitive. I think he relapses. He recovers and relapses, recovers and relapses, recovers and relapses. And that just felt a little bit grinding from a cinematic point of view. I thought the performances were very, very good, though. I think Steve Carell's great. And as someone who's going through an Office rewatch at the moment, it was lovely to see him and Amy Ryan together. although I can't remember if they actually share any scenes, but they certainly share a phone call as she plays his ex-wife. Yeah. They do share a scene. Of course they do, yes. Because, of course, that's Michael Scott and Holly Flax from The Office, and that's lovely. But 4 stars then for Beautiful Boy. If you want to check that out this weekend, go ahead. Time now then for our last movie, which is Mary, Queen of Scots, in which Saoirse Ronan stars as Mary, Queen of Scots, who returns to Scotland to assume her throne. But meanwhile, in England, her cousin, Queen Elizabeth, Margot Robbie, is threatened by new Catholic monarch. Helen, can you imagine such a thing?
Oh, terror.
A Catholic on the throne.
Nightmare.
What is going on? Before we get into what's going on, let's hear a clip.
We have a scourge upon our land. Tis a woman with a crown.
Your beauty. Bravery. Now I see there is no cause for envy. Your gifts will be your downfall. Should you murder me, remember you murder your sister. And you murder your queen.
That was a trailer for Mary, Queen of Scots. And now Helen O'Hara, the person who wrote the Empire Review, please unload upon Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. First of all, it's, you know, beautifully staged, beautiful looking, not terribly convincing always in terms of its history. I mean, Mary's Scottish castle is half hewn from the bare rock, apparently, which I'm not quite what Holyrood House looks like, but fine.
What's the time frame for this movie, by the way? Because I just did a quick bit of Wikipedia.
Oh, amazing.
I haven't seen the film yet, but I read that Mary, Queen of Scots, was in her 40s, according to Wikipedia, when she was... but
she was imprisoned for a long time first, though. She was imprisoned for about, I think it was 9 years or something.
So does that cover that period? Or is this like all take place in a week?
Essentially goes up to the point where she was imprisoned, and then there's a little bit later on, but not really. Okay. The focus is much earlier. So she had gone as essentially a baby to be married to the King of France-to-be.
The Dauphin,
thank you. He became Francis II, if memory serves, but was a bit rubbish and died quite soon after. I mean, he wasn't rubbish because he died, but he was also rubbish. So she came back to Scotland and was one of the most sort of eligible bachelorettes in Europe at the time. And the problem was that most of the Scottish lawyers by this point were not just like sort of touchy-feely, tea with vicar, Church Scotland, but like quite extreme kind of puritanical Protestantism. So they did not exactly welcome this Catholic queen, and a ruling queen as well was still pretty controversial at the time. So she had trouble with her own lords, never mind her cousin in England, who wasn't entirely comfortable with another Catholic queen on the island either. Mm. So it's setting up a really, really uncomfortable situation. Saoirse Ronan, who does a Scottish accent, which is probably wrong historically. I would have thought she'd have a French, but fine.
Apparently she did have a French accent. Oh, yes, I read that.
But I guess it kind of makes sense. But she comes back and...
Unless she's just in a really bad French accent.
No, I think we can trust her. Immediately tangles with David Tennant's John Knox, who immediately starts preaching against her. Her half-brother James, who's played by James McArdle, is fabulous. He's basically her closest ally, but even his loyalty's tested. She makes an extremely bad choice of marriage. She's then forced into an even worse marriage. It's not a good time for her, but it is quite an entertaining zip through her life. And what they've done with this film is to give it a real weirdly modern feminist twist, yeah, which is to basically discuss the fact that these two women were both isolated in a man's world very much, where they were forced to compete against each other, essentially, when each of them is the only person that might understand the other's situation.
Yeah.
So it's a classic, you know, technique, the patriarchy, boo. but it's quite an effective way of looking at it, and it's an angle that we haven't seen endlessly on Mary, Queen of Scots before, because I feel like we've seen a lot of stories about, oh, you know, tragic, oh,
Rain.
Romantic, oh, whatever else. Well, Rain is one of the most ridiculous shows I've ever seen. It's wonderful. But yeah, Josie Warwick, the director, has, I think, found a really new spin on it, and I always welcome that.
Yeah,
it
had completely colorblind casting as well, which I found was very interesting. Gemma Chan's in it, Adrian Lester's in it. This is written by Bo Willimon, who kind of showran and did House of Cards. Mm-hmm. And I did not love this film. I loved the performances in it. I thought Margot Robbie was great. I thought Saoirse Ronan was amazing. And I found it really interesting to watch in terms of the way it portrayed them and in terms of the way the kind of message was men are awful to women. And they have been for quite a long time. But my issue with this is it's not a pacey film. It's quite boring in places, and that's fine if you're being a slave to history, but it takes such liberties with the history that I think if you're going to do that, make it more interesting, because it didn't hold my attention and it did really sag in places. So I kind of wish that if they were going to, because I mean obviously Mary Queen of Scots and Elizabeth did not meet in a hut. I mean, that didn't happen. That's basically, William Wallace and Sophie Marceau getting it on in Braveheart. Like, it's pure fiction. And so much creative license is taken with the storyline. You feel a little bit like, okay, well, if you're going to do that, it would have killed you to have had, like, the Justice League in there or something. I don't know. Make it more fun. But, you know, it's fine. Great performances. It's, you know, a little bit of history, except not actual history.
Yeah, but you know, there's some bits that are very historical and we haven't seen done endlessly, and that's good. But you're right. I mean, one key scene is invented entirely, and I didn't even think it was that good a scene, so that was kind of disappointing.
No, neither did I, but you know, they had some lovely frocks.
They did have some amazing frocks, yeah, and head dresses.
Yes, excellent wig action.
So we gave it 4 stars. Well,
four
I
stars
did.
Helen gave it 4 stars.
Helen gave it 4 stars.
I'd have given it 3.
No one can agree on the star ratings.
Three stars for the film, 1 star for historical accuracy.
Okay. All right, what about the accents?
Oh, 5.
Where do you rate the accents on a level of, oh, jings, crevins, where is me washboard? I don't know why I'm saying that, but
I had no idea Saoirse Ronan was on this podcast. It's extraordinary.
Holy crap, cock-a-leaky. Is that what she says?
You realise that if we ever end up going on tour with the podcast to Scotland, you're going to get lynched for that.
If we were to ever take this podcast to a live show in Scotland?
Yeah. If we were ever to do that, you wouldn't come out alive.
That's almost certainly not going to happen at any point in the not-too-distant future. Cryptic hint. 4 stars then for Mary Queen of Scots. Well done. Well done to the whole of Scots family on that. Congratulations to you. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by...
Nicole Kidman.
Oh, we couldn't get a big star? Yeah. What?
The famous interview in which I forget to press record.
Oh,
and then
God.
We have to start again and she thinks I'm an idiot for the rest of the interview. As, let's be honest, most people do.
It is fair.
Imagine jumping to that conclusion within minutes of meeting you.
Anyway, until we meet again, until an auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye.
Is that it?
Well, I was obviously going to say goodbye and don't forget to listen to the Pilot TV podcast on Monday, but of course you'll cut it out, so, you know.
Jane, you made a note? You made a note, Jane? Yeah, good. All right. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodlepip, bye-bye.
Goodbye. I hope your cold gets better.
Thank you.
The evidence of that cold may have been expertly cut out of the podcast, but believe me, Helen has a cold.
I've been sneezing and coughing the whole way through.
There's phlegm dripping from the ceiling.
Oh, good Lord. Gross.
That's not phlegm.
Oh.
It's ectoplasm.
That's precisely what I was going for. Thanks, James. And it's goodbye from Terry White.
See you.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to take a leaf out of Jason Reitman's book and finish something that my dad started doing 30 years ago. So, 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle of Ian Paisley's face. I'm coming for you. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye!